Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, found on the internet at hallel.info. That's hallel.info, hallel.info. Yeshua HaMashiach, or Jesus, and his apostle Shimon Kefa, or Simon Peter, pointed to the days of Noah as important for believers to fully understand so that they would be prepared for life now and for the coming of the Son of Man. The following is a recorded discussion of the Torah section Noach, which is Hebrew for Noah, and it covers basically Genesis 6 through 11. In it, we're going to learn that though Noach's generation had forgotten, he remembered the Creator was in charge. We'll also learn how the conscience rather than the judgment is key to understanding why God sent the flood in the first place. Noach followed his instructions and didn't have the malice of the world around him. The relationship between God and Noach was a two-way street, and it is because of this one man's trust in God that all of creation was saved.
This section regarding Noah starts in Genesis 6, starting at verse 9, going through chapter 11 to verse 32. The story is dominantly about Noah and his family, the descendants thereof, and what happens, of course, during the flood. And we'll discuss that today. So Genesis chapter 6, starting in verse 9. These are the offspring of Noah. Noah was a righteous man, perfect in his generations. Noah walked with God. Noah had begotten three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Now the earth had become corrupt before God, and the earth had become filled with robbery. And God saw the earth, and behold, it was corrupted, for all flesh had corrupted its way upon the earth. God said to Noah, "The end of all flesh has come before me, for the earth is filled with robbery through them. And behold, I am about to destroy them from the earth. Make for yourself an ark of gopher wood. Make the ark with compartments, and cover it inside and out with pitch. This is how you should make it. 300 cubits the length of the ark, 50 cubits its width, and 30 cubits its height. A window shall you make for the ark, and to a cubit finish it from above. Put the entrance of the ark in its side. Make it with a bottom, second, and third decks. And as for me, behold, I am about to bring the flood waters upon the earth, destroy all flesh in which there is breath of life, from under the heavens. Everything that is in the earth shall expire. But I will establish my covenant with you, and you shall enter the ark, you, your sons, your wife, your sons' wives with you. And from all that lives, of all flesh, two of each shall you bring into the ark to keep alive with you. They shall be male and female, from each bird according to its kind, and from each animal according to its kind, from each thing that creeps on the ground according to its kind, two of each shall come to you to keep alive. And as for you, take yourself of every food that is eaten, and gather it into yourself, that it shall be as food for you and for them." Noah did according to everything God commanded him, so he did. Chapter 7. And the Lord said to Noah, "Come to the ark, you and all your household, for it is you that I have seen to be righteous before me in this generation. Of every clean animal take unto you 7 pairs, a male with its mate, and the animal that is not clean, 2, a male with its mate. Of the birds of the heaven also 7 pairs, male and female, to keep seed alive upon the face of all the earth. For in 7 more days' time I will send rain upon the earth, 40 days and 40 nights, and I will blot out all existence that I have made from upon the face of the ground." Noah did according to everything the Lord had commanded him. Noah was 600 years old when the flood water was upon the earth. Noah, with his sons, his wife, and his sons' wives with him, went into the ark because of the waters of the flood. Of the clean animal, of the animal that is not clean, of the birds, and of each thing that creeps upon the ground, two by two, that came to Noah into the ark, male and female, as God had commanded Noah. And it came to pass after the 7-day period that the waters of the flood were upon the earth. In the 600th year of Noah's life, in the 2nd month, on the 17th day of the month, on that day all the fountains of the great deep burst forth, and the windows of the heavens were opened, and the rain was upon the earth 40 days and 40 nights. On that very day Noah came with Shem, Ham, and Japheth, Noah's sons, with Noah's wife, and the three wives of his sons with them into the ark. They and every beast after its kind, every animal after its kind, every creeping thing that creeps the earth after its kind, every bird after its kind, and every bird of any kind of wing. They came into Noah to the ark, two by two, of all flesh which there was breath of life. Thus they that came male and female of all flesh, as God had commanded him. And the Lord shut it on his behalf. When the flood was on the earth 40 days, the waters increased and raised the ark so that it was lifted above the earth. The waters strengthened and increased greatly upon the earth. And the ark drifted upon the surface of the waters. The waters strengthened very much upon the earth. All the high mountains which are under the entire heavens were covered. 15 cubits upward did the waters strengthen, and the mountains were covered. And all flesh that moves upon the earth expired. Among the birds, the animals, the beasts, and all the creeping things that creep on the earth, and all mankind, all in whose nostrils was the breath of the spirit of life, of everything that was on dry land, died. And he blotted out all existence that was on the face of the ground, from man to animals, to creeping things, and to the bird of the heavens. And they were blotted out from the earth. Only Noah survived, and those with him in the ark. And the waters strengthened on the earth 150 days. Chapter 8. God remembered Noah and all the beasts and all the animals that were with him in the ark. God caused a spirit to pass over the earth, and the waters subsided. The fountains of the deep and the windows of the heavens were closed, and the rain from heaven was restrained. The waters then receded from upon the earth, receding continuously, and the waters diminished at the end of 150 days. And the ark came to rest in the 7th month, on the 17th day of the month, upon the mountains of Ararat. The waters were continuously diminishing until the 10th month. In the 10th month, on the 1st of the month, the tops of the mountains became visible. And it came to pass, at the end of 40 days, that Noah opened the window of the ark which he had made. And he sent out the raven, and it kept going and returning until the waters dried from upon the earth. Then he sent out the dove from him to see whether the waters had subsided from the face of the ground. But the dove could not find a resting place for the sole of its foot, and it returned to him to the ark. For water was upon the surface of all the earth. So he put forth his hand and took it, and brought it to him to the ark. He waited again another 7 days, and again sent out the dove from the ark. The dove came back to him in the evening, and behold, an olive leaf. It had plucked with its bill. And Noah knew the waters had subsided from upon the earth. They waited another 7 days, and sent the dove forth, and it did not return to him any more. It came to pass in the 601st year, in the 1st month, on the 1st of the month, the waters dried from upon the earth. Noah removed the covering of the ark and looked. Behold, the surface of the ground had dried. And in the 2nd month, on the 27th day of the month, the earth was fully dry. God spoke to Noah, saying, Go forth from the ark, you and your wife, your sons, and your sons' wives with you. Every living being that is with you, of all the flesh, of birds and of animals, and all moving things that move on the earth, order them out with you, and let them teem on the earth to be fruitful and multiply on the earth. So Noah went forth, and his sons, his wife, and his sons' wives with him. Every living being, every creeping thing, every bird, everything that moves on the earth came out of the ark by their families. Then Noah built an altar to the Lord and took of every clean animal and of every clean bird and offered burnt offerings on the altar. The Lord smelled the pleasing aroma, and the Lord said in his heart, I will not continue to curse again the ground because of man, since the imagery of man's heart is evil from his youth. Nor will I again continue to smite every living being as I have done. Continuously all the days of the earth, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night, shall not cease. Chapter 9. God blessed Noah and his sons, and he said to them, Be fruitful and multiply and fill the land. The fear of you and the dread of you shall be upon every beast of the earth and upon every bird of the heavens, in everything that moves on the earth, and in all the fish of the sea, in your hand they are given. Every moving thing that lives shall be food for you, like the green herbage I have given you everything. But flesh with its soul, its blood, you shall not eat. However, your blood, which belongs to your souls, I will demand. Of every beast I will demand it. But of man, of every man, for that of his brother, I will demand the soul of a man. Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man his blood be shed. For in the image of God he made man. And you, be fruitful and multiply. Teem on the earth and multiply on it. God said to Noah and to his sons with him, saying, And as for me, behold, I establish my covenant with you and with your offspring after you, with every living being that is with you, with the birds, with the animals, with every beast of land with you, of all that departed the ark to every beast of the land, and I will confirm my covenant with you. Never again shall all flesh be cut off by the waters of the flood, and never again shall there be a flood to destroy the earth. And God said, This is a sign of the covenant that I give between me and you, and every living being that is with you, for two generations forever. I have set my rainbow in the cloud, and it shall be a sign of the covenant between me and the earth. And it shall happen, when I place a cloud over the earth, and the bow will be seen in the cloud, I will remember my covenant between me and you, and every living being among all flesh. And the water shall never again become a flood to destroy all flesh. The bow shall be in the cloud, and I will look upon it, remember. Sorry, lost my place here. The everlasting covenant between God and every living being among all flesh is on the earth. And God said to Noah, This is the sign of the covenant that I have confirmed between me and all flesh is upon the earth. The sons of Noah who came out of the ark were Shem, Ham, and Japheth, Ham being the father of Canaan. These three were the sons of Noah, and from these the whole world was spread out. Noah, the man of the earth, debased himself and planted a vineyard. He drank of the wine and became drunk, and he uncovered himself within his tent. Ham, the father of Canaan, saw his father's nakedness and told his two brothers outside. And Shem and Japheth took a garment, laid it upon both their shoulders, and they walked backwards and covered their father's nakedness. Their faces were turned away, and they saw not their father's nakedness. Noah awoke from his wine and realized what his small son had done to him. And he said, Cursed is Canaan. A slave of slaves shall he be to his brothers. And he said, Blessed is the Lord, the God of Shem, let Canaan be a slave to them. May God extend Japheth, but he will dwell in the tents of Shem. May Canaan be a slave to them. Noah lived after the flood 350 years, and all the days of Noah were 950 years, and he died. These are the descendants, the sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Sons were born to them after the flood. The sons of Japheth were Gomer, Magog, Madai, Javan, Tubal, Meshech, Tiras. The sons of Gomer, Ashkenaz, Riphath, Togomar. The sons of Javan, Elisha, Tarshish, Kittim, and Dodanim. From these, the islands of the nations were separated in their lands, each according to its language by the families in their nations. The sons of Ham were Cush, Mizraim, Put, and Canaan. The sons of Cush, Seba, Havilah, Sabta, Ramah, Sabteca. The sons of Ramah were Sheba and Dedan. Cush begot Nimrod. He was the first to be a mighty man on the earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Therefore it is said, like Nimrod, a mighty hunter before the Lord. The beginning of his kingdom was Babel, Erech, Akkad, Calneh, in the land of Shinar. From that land, Asher went forth and built Nineveh, Rehovot-ir, and Calah, and Rezin between Nineveh and Calah, that is the great city. Mitzrayim begot Ludim, Ananim, Libahim, Naphtuhim, Pathushim, and Kasluhim. Hence the Philistines came forth, and Kaphturim. Canaan begot Zidon, his firstborn, and Het, and the Jebusite, and the Amorite, the Girgashite, the Hivite, the Arkite, the Sinite, the Avaradite, the Zimmerite, the Hamathite, and afterward the families of the Canaanites branched out. The Canaanite boundary extended from Zidon going toward Gerar as far as Gaza, going toward Sodom and Gomorrah, Adamah, and Zeboim, as far as Lasha. These the descendants of Ham by their families, by the languages, and their lands, and the nations. To Shem also to him were born. He was the ancestor of all those who lived on the other side, the brother of Japheth the elder. The sons of Shem, Elam, Ashur, Arpachshad, Lud, Aram. The sons of Aram were Uz, Hul, Geter, and Mash. Arpachshad begot Shelah, and Shelah begot Eber. And Eber were born two sons. The first was Peleg, for in his day the earth was divided. And the name of his brother was Joktan. Joktan begot Almodad, Shelef, Hazarabet, whatever the guy's name is, Jira, Hadoram, Uzal, Dikla, Obal, Abimel, Sheba, Ophir, Havilah, and Jobab. All these were the sons of Joktan. Their dwelling place extended from Mesha going towards Sefer, the mountain to the east. These the descendants of Shem, according to their families by their languages and their lands by their nations. These the families of Noah's descendants, according to generations by their nations, and from these the nations were separated on the earth after the flood. Chapter 11. The whole earth was of one language and of one common purpose. And it came to pass, when they migrated from the east, they found a valley in the land of Shinar and settled there. And they said to one another, "Come, let us make bricks and burn them in fire." And the brick served them as stone, and the bitumen served them as mortar. And they said, "Come, let us build a city and a tower with its top in the heavens. And let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be widespread across the whole earth." The Lord descended to look at the city and tower which the sons of man built. And the Lord said, "Behold, they are one people with one language for all. And this they begin to do. And now, should it not be withheld from them all that they propose to do? Come, let us ascend and therefore confuse their language. They should not understand one another's language." The Lord dispersed them from there over the face of the whole earth, and they stopped building the city. That is why it's called Babel, because it was there the Lord had confused the language of the whole earth. And from there the Lord scattered them over the face of the whole earth. These the descendants of Shem. Shem was 100 years old when he begot Arphaxad, 2 years after the flood. Shem lived 500 years after beginning Arphaxad, and he begot sons and daughters. Arphaxad had lived 35 years when he begot Shelah. And Arpachshad lived 403 years after beginning Shelah, and begot sons and daughters. Shelah lived 30 years and begot Eber. And Shelah lived 403 years after begetting Eber and begot sons and daughters. When Eber lived 34 years, she begot Peleg. And Eber lived 430 years and begot after begetting Peleg and begot sons and daughters. When Peleg had lived 30 years, he begot Reu. And Peleg lived 209 years after begetting Reu. He begot sons and daughters. When Reu had lived 32 years, he begot Serug. And Reu lived 207 years after begetting Serug and begot sons and daughters. When Serug had lived 30 years, he begot Nahor. And Serug lived 200 years after begetting Nahor, begot sons and daughters. When Nahor had lived 29 years, he begot Terah. And Nahor lived 119 years after begetting Terah, and begot sons and daughters. When Terah lived 70 years, he begot Abram, Nahor, and Haran. Now these are the chronicles of Terah. Terah begot Abram, Nahor, and Haran begot Lot. Haran died in the lifetime of Terah's father, in his native land, in the Ur of Chasadim. And Abram and Nahor took themselves wives. The name of Abram's wife was Sarai. The name of Nahor's wife was Milcah, the daughter of Haran, the father of Milcah, the father of Iscah. And Sarah was barren, and she had no children. Terah took his son Abram and Lot, the son of Haran, his grandson, and his daughter-in-law Sarai, the wife of Abram, his son, and they departed with them from Ur Chasidim to go to the land of Canaan. And they arrived at Haran, and they settled there. The days of Terah were 205 years, and Terah died in Haran. A lot of reading. So that's basically the story of what happens from Noah and from chapter 6, verse 9, through chapter 11, verse 32. Before we go into our discussion about the different issues and things that are brought up in this reading cycle, are there any comments, questions, or opinions, or things I can answer for you quickly, because I may not actually be covering every detail. It is quite lengthy. So, any opinions, thoughts, or beliefs? Go ahead. We'll go for it.
So, in chapter 6, 21, he talks about gathering all the food that is edible. Mm-hmm. And that will be for him to eat, and the animals are all that are with him. I'm not sure.
Right.
Then, of course, in 9, when they're coming out of the ark, he says, every moving thing that is alive shall be food for you. I give all to you as I gave the green plant. So if I'm understanding that right, I understand there's a couple different ideas on that, but and maybe you could address it. But what I'm getting from that is the fact that he mentions as I gave the green plant, which would then put it back into only clean animals. Because of the reference of the clean plants, because obviously they were only allowed to eat clean plants. So I'd just like to hear what you have to say on that particular thing there. And then the other thing, and I'm sure you're probably going to address this, but, you know, the whole thing with Ham, the nakedness of the father, mm-hmm. Cursed Canaan, however you say it. And then it's kind of funny that I don't understand his curse there or why he's cursed. I don't know if it was disobedience, the fact that he went out joking, hey, daddy's naked and drunk, and the other brothers were obedient and covered him. But then he goes on to have quite
many
a
children.
Large territory. All the ites seem to come uh-huh. from him. Yeah. So it seems that he went forth and multiplied. And then also Nimrod, very interesting character. I've read a little bit on it, and it seems that, you know, there's a lot of problems with Nimrod and the cities that were built, and I was just wondering if you were going to address that. So that's it.
As far as a few of these things I had not planned on addressing. I'll address some really quickly right now. Nimrod, regarding the cities he built, yeah, he built many cities. He was obviously a very powerful individual. As far as the mighty hunter and things that he killed and whatever he hunted, Nimrod's biggest hunting success was hunting of men, not by killing men, but by gathering them together to his own. That we would consider them a warlord. Yeah. Due to what he was successful, he was the first mighty or great man after the flood that was on the earth. Well, as a result, legends came from him from generation to come. By the way, he's in charge of Babel, which splits off. Well, he's still alive when that event happens. He may have died during it, I don't really know. But he was alive when that happened. So when all the languages split, they divide off. The memory and knowledge of him went with them in their own language with no follow-up information. Like, for example, we see presents come, they do their thing, good or bad, they lose their presidency, and then they tag along doing various things throughout the life until they finally pass away and we do some kind of salute to them. Well, in Nimrod's case, that didn't happen. And we see him doing great things, this massive tower he's building, however big it was, I don't really know. And then they all split, take off. Well, they don't see him come down. As far as come down in a sense of honor and greatness. His greatness didn't diminish. People still stayed there. Many still stayed there in the Babel territory in Shinar. Many of the culture separated, but some of them stayed because they had the same language. Well, that culture had history. So they had Nimrod, Nimrod's son, all the various descendants. All the languages that split didn't. So their last memory, their cultural memory, is of him being great and this massive, powerful individual of where they came from, but then they had to leave. So there's no consecutive, no closure to his storyline. As a result, myths and stories grow from that. When you have an unknown, a black box, so to speak, stories are invented. Stories are created to explain the black box. They don't know what it is, they don't know what happened. So it's a mystery what happened to Nimrod to all the other nations of different languages, because they didn't spend their time to find out what happened to him or pay attention. They don't have Google or news search, the Newsmax that flashes things out to them. It's a slow process to get information. So when they all split up, it facilitated a great growth of myth around the individual that was once great. A lot of myths grew up that way. So when Nimrod, because he was great at that moment in time, his name and his history and the stories about him were then created and held on to those various languages and cultures as they divided up. They may have changed his name over time. Mind you, they were different languages. They would have a different name for him, not by the Nimrod that we would know. They call him whatever name they can think of. That's his title. But they would create the stories about him, his family, how great he once was. He was almost like a god. Look, he built this massive tower. He was a god, that kind of thing. So that's how the stories develop. And as a result, many fake or fictitious beliefs or religions, traditions start to show up because of it. With folklore and different stories, it's that type of system. So that's how that works. It also occurred within the people who still were there with him, because he was also facilitating his own grandiose, history. Yes.
But this is why pretty much every nation group has various legends about a flood that wiped out the whole world. They all have various legends about the family, the one and only family that ended up being saved out of all families of the earth.
Right.
Whether you're talking about the Chinese, the Aboriginal Australians.
The Native Americans.
All have various legends about one family who, and usually they do retain the number 8. Mm-hmm. They retain some kind of reference to a boat and a flood. And
all the animals. Yep. Yeah. Yep. All the stories continue on. And that God intended it to be that way. So we would never forget. It's like permanently seared into our cultural conscience. Yes.
I was probably referring to this, but in China, the oldest writing, it's all these little different lines and pictures made of lines. The oldest language of China that they know of, anyway, has for the word boat, it's a picture of a boat, the staff, mm-hmm. with 8 people in it.
Oh, really? That's funny. It's a pictographical language, so it makes sense. You're going to draw whatever it's supposed to be. That's interesting. Okay, so that's addressed your question regarding Nimrod and his cities. He built many cities. Obviously, cultures and myths and everything else grew from them. His descendants, of course, that's where we get the Nineveh from, which comes up with Jonah. He shows up the great city of Nineveh. That's still the same descendants. We get Assyrians come from there, Babylonians come from there. They're all descendants of Nimrod and his family line. Or, not Nimrod, sorry. This is of that area. Not Nimrod himself, but of that area. Because Nimrod was actually descended from Ham. The other ones were descendants of Shem. But they grew up and took over the territory that Nimrod was once ruler of. So they facilitated and grew up in his shadow, so to speak. Yes?
I can't remember right now, but wasn't Ishtar or somebody like that, the wife of Nimrod and the son?
There is. Ishtar is what, I don't recall his, again, part of legends, right? Part of stories you brought up. His wife and, of course, the children that they have. Note, much like the pharaohs, which kept the tradition of descendants of the gods, the same thing that Nimrod had started or worked with, in that each member, each spouse, they were all somehow biologically attached to the gods, which for the Greeks did the same thing. That every great leader, they're great because they must be some descendant of God, because nothing else could be so great. It's, as opposed to reality, that's just how people work. So that's how, again, so his wife became part of the legends, and she goes by many names. the term Easter is one of the many names she's called. There's a lot of other things, too. Yes?
I was reading something, and I didn't research it or know whether, but I seen a thing, you know, that showed Adam and all the descendants, and then their Hebrew, you know, definition, and it pretty much laid out, you know, needed a Messiah. I don't remember the...
Their names.
Yes.
Their names, yeah.
But also, I saw the same thing with Nimrod and his cities. And each city had a name. And then if you laid those names out, it kind of talked about the diversity of the people and how they would fall apart and go away.
Right.
And I don't remember all that, but just seemed very interesting in that whole Nimrod story and the false gods and legends that you were
referring to. Yep. That's if most Hebrew names that come in list form in the Bible. And granted, to be fair, I didn't do it in this case. There's a lot of names. but each of the times you have a list of either names of cities or names of people, a consecutive list, because of the way the Hebrew language works, each name has a definition. Actually, it means something. Whatever the meaning may be, it can vary some by context, but every name has a meaning. So because those meanings, if you place the names in a paragraphical phrase, start just writing them all out and in their definitions and how they describe it, you can actually read information about it. Most of the time, it'll point out to, you know, the fall of a man, mankind in general, its destruction, its debaseness, and then needing somebody will come to save them or bring them back. And that's almost every list will tell you something along the same lines of a story when that's written, whether it's a city's names or whether it's people's names. The way the Bible wrote them out and broke them in order, that's how it's done. It's more telling when, for example, in Joshua, when he goes to conquer the various cities, he conquers the cities in a particular order. But the listing of the order, when he lists the cities, they rearrange the order when it's listed, as far as the cities he conquered, different than the order which he conquered them. Well, when you spell it out, when the listing, the way it's listed, is telling you information. It actually has a whole thought process of what it's trying to tell you with all these different city names. If you do the order which he conquered them in, it doesn't quite make as much sense because the sequence doesn't quite make sense. But when you relisted them, someone, whoever it was, relisted the city list in Joshua, and the actual names tell you stuff. That's one of the telling events that somebody actually thought about this, or God, or somebody, whoever did, the order which had been listed in, different than the order which was conquered. Most names are that way, list names, just say, are that way within your Torah. It's pretty consistent. It's very time-consuming to go through it. To be fair, it takes many hours to go through each name and figure out what it all means and its history and its root words, all that stuff. So I didn't go through it this time around. But you're certainly welcome to. It's an interesting read, interesting way of finding things out. Let's see, your last question, or a couple questions you had. You had, we'll talk about Ham and the curse and such that a little bit later. It says the food for you, the food for animals, food for mankind. In chapter 6, because obviously the food for animals you're gathering, what are the animals supposed to be eating? Well, as Adam and Eve were instructed, the animals were all assigned to be eating vegetables, fruits, tree pieces, whatever case it be. That's their function, their task to eat. Nothing indicates that God had changed that instruction to the animals. Not until after the flood do we have any indication that there's any kind of change. So whether or not animals were eating each other before the flood doesn't make a difference. They probably were. But whichever animals God chose to send to the ark, of all the different kinds and the different species and subspecies and everything else there is imaginable, he chose particular ones that would be content to eat vegetables. whatever kind they were, and whether they were, you know, lions and tigers and bears, or whether they were, you know, rats and mice and ants. Whatever, they were all there. They were content to eat with what food was on the ark. Whether or not, I couldn't tell you whether they were all babies. They were probably about the young animals, because it is pointless to gather the biggest, largest animals and put them on the ark because they're old and ready to die. You don't repopulate planet Earth with big, old animals. You repopulate with young, relatively young, small animals. That just makes logical sense. God's not going to send a 40-year-old elephant and say, okay, now go forth and multiply, and a year later it dies of old age. It doesn't make a lot of sense. He's going to send somebody who's probably in the 1 or 2-year-old elephant range kind of thing, a young one. They do live long. So all the bodies and all the things, he would have sent small, young ones to repopulate. It makes very sense. Oh, go ahead. What's your question? Why do they populate a particular area? I give you a basic, this is very basic explanation. It's not exhaustive. So if I have an animal group, we'll put animal number triangle. That's the animal type, whatever it is. It has babies. You have children too, right? Do all your children look the same? No. They have similarities, but not the same. So this triangle animal, let's say it's baby. This one has a small triangle. It's a little lopsided. This one's more like a square-ish rather than a triangle. And this one's like a circle looking. It's still the same parent, but they look a little different. The point is, each of these animals will succeed depending on where they live. So if this animal, let's say this circle animal, is hairy, we call it a woolly mammoth if it was from an elephant. Let's say it's hairy. Is it going to be really happy where the sun beats down on it every day of its life? No. It'll get really, really hot. It won't be happy there. So where is it going to go? Where it's not quite so hot. I don't want to be staying out in the sun. I don't want to hang out in the sun all day long. I'm boiling, I'm dripping. If I could sweat, I'd be sweating the whole time. So where's it going to go? Somewhere it's colder. Where do you find the skeletons of woolly mammoths? You know, up where it's cold, or where it once was cold. They went to coldness. Well, you may have another animal that is relatively small. One of the children could be a runt, who knows? Mind you, we're talking, this is, genetics is in its near pure state at this point. It's still relatively pure. So it could be anything will succeed or succeed in its growth pattern as it grows, because its genetics are not contaminated like ours are today, where you know you have incestuous issues that have come up over the years of people begetting people. So animals are pretty successful on their genetic code. So this animal over here, let's say this animal here is small. Well, do you need a small animal to dwell in the massive open plains? Not typically. Small animals are successful in tight, confined areas because they're small. Usually you hang out in mountainous regions or hilly regions where you don't need lots of open space. So small animals may be somewhere else. I forgot the name of the elephant that lives in the jungle, the small one. It's a miniaturized one with little stripes. I forgot its name. It's a tiny one. And whatever I say, there's a small one that lives, it has it's a toy elephant. They're small ones, but they live in jungle areas. And there's small animals. A tapir, that was it. Tapir is a type of tapir. It's a relative or descendant of elephant range, a tapir. And they live in jungle areas, very tight, very confined. Well, if that's the case, they all came from the same kind. They're just variations thereof. And they grow and they succeed in the areas. If a tapir being very small, he's very easy to hunt in the open plain if you're a lion, aren't you? So you're going to hang out in the open plain where everybody's going to eat you? Not if you have any ounce of knowledge to say, hey, it's safer where the trees are. So tapir runs away. It hangs out in the trees. You get the point? That each of the descendants, I can only take a single kind of an animal that's relatively clean in its genetic code, and it can have a whole host of descendants. The descendants will then migrate and hang out in the areas that they're most successful in. So elephants today, large ones, which can endure the great heat and great desert of Africa, still survive there. Now, mind you, the Asian elephant isn't in Africa, it's in Asia. It's a much more moist climate. It's also a smaller elephant, too. Yes, David.
I just wanted to piggyback on what you were saying. I read a really interesting article on this professor that talks about, you know, the animals of its kind, saying that, you know, if you take the cats of today, it's not like they had all these cats in the ark. There was two of its kind, and from there came the multiple, just like you're saying.
The multiple hosts, right.
And it fits perfectly within the genetic codes that this professor researched, and it just made complete sense. And he became a believer after looking at all that. But his point was to prove that you couldn't fit all these animals in the ark.
Right. You couldn't fit every single animal because it wouldn't make any sense. So as you point out, the cats alone would fill the ark. All the subspecies of cat. Yeah, it's of its kind is the answer. So, and that includes, what about all the different types of bugs there are? I mean, seriously, look around all the bugs and beetles there are in the world. If you have two of every kind of bug and beetle, that's the ark has its own wing with just the insect section alone, because there's so many different types. But again, if you take down to what's the kind it comes from, I don't need every species of cockroach. I wouldn't have minded if you left those behind. But once one pair is enough to have the descendants of every species of cockroach to follow, because the initial pairs that God created were fully genetically clean. I mean, they had the whole host of everything available to them. Jeff pointed out last week that even our own bodies are missing or shutting. Sorry, many of our genetic codes have been shut off. They don't work anymore. They don't work functionally. You wonder why Adam and Eve can live to 1,000, we can only live to at most 120 for lucky? Look at his genetic code. His body can clean itself up far better than ours can. So a lot of things have changed over time, and genetic codes have gotten weaker and been more isolated, and problems have happened, and time has elapsed. There's a reason why God said all of creation yearns and groans for Him. Because we see that we're dying. We're not as successful and as He originally designed us to be. Yes, sir.
And as you get older, you're growing louder.
You're growing louder. If you get older, you're growing louder. That's true. So the food. So all the animals come originally with plants and plants and things. When it comes out of the ark, he opens up, okay, the animals are for food. Now, mind you, God pointed out to Noah, you have clean animals and you have unclean animals. So Noah knows when he comes out of the ark, because he's offering one of every single clean species there is of both bird and ones that creep on the ground. So he knows what's clean, what's not clean. How would he know that? Who told him? Yeah, exactly. Well, did he spend the first 500 years of his life studying animals? I really don't know. Maybe he did. But the point is, God or somebody had to inform him what was clean and what wasn't. Now we think, okay, distinguish between clean and unclean. Well, we know that what it means. It means what's edible, what is food, what is not food. So a human being is unclean, therefore I shouldn't eat them. That makes sense. They're an unclean thing. Well, a chicken, we understand or believe, is clean. There, I can eat it. Now, what's between chicken and an animal and a human? A lot of things. But somehow Noah identified that there was clean and there was unclean. If he knew that, and God pointed out him seven of all the clean pairs, I'm assuming if Noah was unsure if the animal was clean, when God sent seven pairs of it, it kind of answered his question for him. Because, oh yeah, that's on the clean side, and check it off. So he would have known the difference between clean and unclean. Therefore, he knows what is food and what isn't food. So human beings are not food. We don't eat them. But cattle is food, because clearly God said it's a clean animal. He sent seven pairs. It's edible. Yes?
So just to clarify my thing, the gentleman over there mentioned clean food.
Yes.
So plants, I think he was talking about.
Plants.
So then there's an implication of the same thing, there was unclean food too.
There's unclean food too. There's other thing that God pointed out when he came out of the ark, which I'll just mention right here at the moment in time, which we're talking about this, is that God said he would end the curse on the ground. Now, when God cursed the ground with Adam, that over the, you will sweat the toil of your brow, you will produce food, it will bring forth food from you. After the flood, God's going to end that curse. He ends it from that point on. So the whole time between Adam and Noah, everyone was struggling to find food. They're working very hard to survive. Good thing their genetic code was really clean because they may not have made it. but after that, God said, now the food will be easier, as far as your plants will just grow as we now perceive them as growing plants. I'm not sure how bad they were before. I'm glad they grow easily now, because otherwise I'd starve. Yes?
God taught them in the very beginning what was clean and unclean for the very first sacrifice. So that had to have been passed down to every generation.
Yep, some knowledge had to have been gone through. Because at Abel and Canaan, Abel's tender of sheep. Well, God's not going, he's going to offer an offering up to Abel, or sorry, to God. Abel's offering up to God. He's choosing of the sheep to do it. And clearly that's of a clean animal. So obviously at some point in time, God imparted the information, or Adam wrote it down. Because Adam was, of course, the man who saw and named every animal. He had to observe how the animal lived, its existence, what it ate, how it lived its life, in order to come up with a name for it. If that's the case, he would have, may have figured out the rules, well, they are, to be clean or unclean. Yes?
Don't you think God played a part in assembling the animals that came?
Well, of course. That's the point. The two of every kind that God would have sent, but if it was a clean animal, he would have sent seven pairs. So if you didn't know if it was clean, God sending you the seven of that, oh, I didn't realize that bird was clean. That tells you, oh, hey, I'll take that off the unclean list and put it on the clean list, because now I actually know I can see that God answered it. Yes?
I believe that God knew, because there's an ecosystem of the entire world. Like, wait, I could just say it would be like a spider's web, but each one of those animals that were unclean, they were scavengers. They're like seafood and shrimp. They all clean the bottom of the ocean. They're part of an ecosystem that keeps it clean. So when Adam did name him, I do believe that that's so, because you see pigs, they'll eat anything. So they would clean the land.
Yep. And snails eat,
yeah,
eat,
you can see
eat a lot
if
of
something
things.
Eats someone else's scat, then that's blue.
You wouldn't want to eat it.
Yeah, but that's what the animals do. They cleaned it up so that, because even human scat, he said,
yep.
Ding and berry.
The flies.
The thing is, yeah, we have to have a way to, so God knew in creating us that our excrements would have to be. So I think that's why those animals, they probably cleaned the ark up too while they were in there.
It's possible. We don't know how. We don't know what life was like. It didn't say.
Yeah.
It doesn't describe it. It's speculation at best.
Well, that's what's happening. People stop thinking, and we've been caused to not think it out and stuff. So I think that helps us what we're doing here and talking about it. I think it's relevant.
It is interesting. It's interesting.
That's what happened to the world.
This little ship.
Our little ship here.
Yes, David.
I find the biggest clue as I was reading it was the fact that there is only two of the unclean animals. So obviously he's not going to put a male and a female pig, for example, into the ark, then open the gate and say, eat whatever you want. Then they kill a pig, and now there's no pig.
Right. Right. Oh, correct. Yes, Kat.
Oh, I'm just wondering, so can you expand a little more on how he got the animals on to the ark?
That's been debated for many, many years. Some have argued that his three sons assisted or helped him gather the animals over the 100-year span of time they had to build the ark. But God points out that he sends the animals 7 days before the ark is to close up. That's not enough time for Noah and his sons to gather one copy or set of every animal on earth. It would take all of man to do that over a very long period of time and debate. They would argue whether this is a separate kind or some descendant thereof, whatever. And they would always choose incorrectly, because God's choosing animals that are relatively clean on their genetic code to start with. He's not going to choose ones that are already contaminated and nasty and gross and have, you know, cancerous sores on them. Wrong type to choose, okay? And a man from the outside can't see that. We can't see the inside of animals. Oh yeah, by the way, your heart's going to fail. You have a valve problem. We don't know, but God would. So us arbitrarily choosing a set wouldn't work very well. God would have to select that, all right, I want this set and not that one and that one. We have to know differences. They've noted that even animals who have died, they found the skeletons of, they've found, they saw samples in the bones of cancer in growing in the bones of fossils. Well, fossils will be set mostly, for the most part, pre-flood events. So that means there was cancerous problems and diseases happening in the bone structure of animals before the flood occurred. God's not going to send a cancer-ridden child or infant or baby of whatever species it is into the ark because it's just going to continue on dying and cause disease. So God would have to be the one who would select them 7 days before, but Noah had 100 years to gather all the food. So all the food had been gathered, so Noah, to know what the animals eat, would have to have been an observer as well. To watch, okay, what does that animal eat? Oh, it doesn't like this food. I need to make sure I have enough for that species. So Noah would have to also have some knowledge on his end to collect the right amount of food he needs for each of the different species he's anticipating to see. Yes?
Yeah, I think the animals heard God's voice. Because, I mean, look at how smart our dogs and birds and everything are. They know you. They know when you're going to come home. My neighbor, I used to see when they drove up, and the dog would be, the people's car would come down the road, the dog would hear the car, the dog would get down out of the window, because the dog was supposed to be in the window. But I think animals were very intuitive and very smart, as you see them training a monkey and birds talking. So I believe that in their code, because it has been marred, which they grown in too, I believe that they were at higher intelligence also.
Yeah, be here, great if he can guide them. Yeah, donkey can talk. Yep.
I mean, that's probably no accident.
No, it doesn't have a voice box like we do, but yet it's able to talk. So clearly God can do a lot of things. They do to some degree. All right, any questions or comments? I have a lot of stuff to go through today. All right. I know, what's up with that, man? Dragging my feet, not doing anything. All right, let's jump to the beginning. So go back to chapter 6. There were certain, I will not be able to cover every detail in this section. I'm sorry, but it's very lengthy. So a few things I will be covering, because I only have so much time to work with. One of the things I'll be talking about is this idea, which is an explanation, because when we read this, when I read this, there's always the immediate question of what life was like during Noah's time. It says, these are the offspring of Noah. Noah was a righteous man, perfect in his iterations. Noah walked with God. He begot three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. The earth became corrupt before God. The earth had become filled with robbery. God saw the earth, and behold, it was corrupt for all flesh, and corrupt its way upon the earth. And God said, the end of flesh become before me. The earth is filled with robbery through them. Behold, I'm about to destroy them from the earth. So this is God's premise. He's starting out with this particular issue as his main focus. His main focus, of course, the earth's destruction or robbery or its corruptness. So robbery is his, you know, his stance he's standing on. And he points out that in this story, Noah is classified as perfect in generation. What does perfect mean? He says he's perfect, yeah, is without blemish. Now, without blemish, that usually implies without flaw, with no errors, no mistakes. Does Noah have errors or mistakes?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, he does. So what makes him perfect? If he has errors and mistakes, and yet God's saying he's perfect. Physical body, it's possible physical body. We're going to discuss the word perfect, and the Bible will explain to us what that means in Noah's time. Yes, Pat? So perfect with righteousness. That's one of the examples it points out. It says he was righteous. Righteousness with God. And of course, following God. He's one of the descendants walking with God. So in the definition which we're having here, as far as we're discovering in this chapter 6, it points out that he was perfect in his generations. I mean, Noah was perfect in his generations. which implies without blemish, though he has faults, he has issues. We find some of those later. But his righteousness, he walks, as an L, with God all of his life, at least most of his life. Many of us today are classified as being perfect. Not in the English definition of the word perfect, meaning without flaw. Perfect meaning that we are clean and we are set aside. Let's go to some, there's a few, the Bible defines perfect very clearly. We're going to explain a little bit as far as what life was like in Noah's time to be able to analyze, understand what it means to be perfect in his life. So we're going to jump immediately to Matthew chapter 5. Not read the whole chapter. Matthew 5, starting in verse 43. There's a quote here that we're going to look at just briefly today to understand what it means for Noah to be perfect compared to his other people around him. So Matthew 5, starting verse 43. You've heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies, bless those who curse you, do good to those who hate you, and pray for those who spitefully use you and persecute you, that you may be sons of your Father in heaven. For he makes his son rise on the evil and the good and sends rain on the just and the unjust. For if you love those who love you, what reward do you have? Do not even the tax collectors do the same? If you greet your brethren only, what do you do more than others? Even tax collectors do so. Therefore, you should be perfect, just as your Father in heaven is perfect. So the example here for Matthew 5, perfect. What does that mean? What is it in his example? He's given in chapter 5. What's the what citations? What examples he's pointing out is considered perfect? It's loving. Loving. Love. Love what? Loving people. Yeah, people. That's what God says is his example of what perfect is. Loving people. This statement here, you should be perfect just as your Father in heaven is perfect, actually comes from somewhere else. It comes from Leviticus. Let's go to Leviticus to explain what that means in the form of loving people. Okay, that's a good example. Does it mean Moses was loved people? It could be. Now, he didn't interact with that many. Obviously, he had his sons, but not that many others. Leviticus, however, gives a better example of what this means by God saying perfect. Go to Leviticus chapter 11. Now, this is most commonly in the book of Leviticus, this phrase, which is quoted, or sorry, paraphrased, I should say not quoted, it's paraphrased in Matthew chapter 5. The paraphrase is this citation. So, the Leviticus of chapter 11, starting in verse 41. 41 of Leviticus 11. Every creeping thing that creeps in the earth shall be an abomination. It shall not be eaten. Whatever crawls on its belly, whatever goes on all fours, whatever has many feet, among all the creeping things that creep in the earth, these you shall not eat, for they are an abomination. You shall not make for yourselves abominable with any creeping thing that creeps, nor shall you make yourselves unclean with them, lest you be defiled by them. For I am the Lord your God. You shall therefore sanctify yourselves, and you shall be holy, for I am holy. Neither shall you defile yourselves with any creeping thing that creeps on the earth. For I am the Lord your God, who brings you out of the land of Egypt to be your God. You shall therefore be holy, for I am holy. This is the law of the beasts, the birds, everything that moves in the waters, every creature that creeps in the earth, the distinction between the unclean and the clean, between the animal that may be eaten and the animal that may not be eaten. Anybody catch what the quote was? Matthew 5 says, be perfect, for the Lord's perfect. Leviticus, the same phrase, it means holy, for the Lord is holy. Matthew 5 is telling us the word perfect is synonymous with the word holy. He's quoting it from Leviticus. Leviticus continues on and says it again. Now, note before I move on, chapter 11 of Leviticus What's its main focus? Food. Don't contaminate yourself. That's its main focus in the chapter 11. What you can and can't eat, what's acceptable, what's not acceptable. So, let's go to Leviticus 19, the next time God talks about this idea of being holy or perfect, because he is. Go to Leviticus 19. I'm not going to read the entire chapter, but the chapter is in the midst of a discussion that he's pointing out the ways in which you will do things in conduct with other people. So sexual sins, who you honor or don't honor, respect other fake gods, that kind of thing. That's in the middle of this section. So Leviticus 19, chapter, starting verse 1. The Lord spoke to Moses saying, speak to all the congregation, the children of Israel, and said to them, you shall be holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy. Every one of you shall revere his mother and father, shall keep my Sabbaths. I am the Lord your God. Do not turn to idols. Do not make yourselves molten gods. I am the Lord your God. If you offer a sacrifice of peace offering to the Lord, you shall offer it of your own free will. It shall be eaten the same day you offer it, and the next day, and it remains until the third day, it shall be burned in the fire. If it is eaten at all on the third day, it is an abomination, it shall not be accepted. Therefore, everyone who eats it shall bear his iniquity, because he has profaned the hallowed offering of the Lord, and that person shall be cut off from his people. When you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not wholly reap the corners of your field, nor shall you gather the gleanings of your harvest. You shall not glean your vineyard, nor shall you gather every grape of your vineyard. You shall leave them for the poor, the stranger. I, the Lord your God. You shall not steal. You shall not deal falsely to one, or lie to one another. You shall not swear by my name falsely. Nor shall you profane the name of the Lord your God. I am the Lord. You shall not defraud your neighbor or rob him. The wages of him who is hired shall remain with you all night until morning. You shall not curse the deaf, nor put a stumbling block before the blind, but shall fear the Lord your God. I am the Lord. You shall do no injustice in judgments. You shall not be partial to the poor, nor honor the person of might, but the righteous you shall judge your neighbor. You shall not go about as a talebearer among your people, nor shall you take a stand against the life of your neighbor. I am the Lord. You shall not hate your brother in your heart. You shall rebuke your neighbor and not bear sin because of him. You shall not take vengeance nor bear any grudge against the children of your people, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord. You shall keep my statutes. You shall not let your livestock breed with another kind. You shall not sow your field with mixed seed, nor shall a garment of mixed linen and wool come upon you. Whoever lies currently with a woman who is betrothed as a concubine to another, and who has not at all been redeemed or given her freedom, for this there shall be scourging, it shall not be put to death, because she was not free. He shall bring his trespass offering to the Lord, the door of the tabernacle meeting, the ram trespass offering. The priest shall make atonement for him with a ram, the trespass offering for the Lord, for his sin which he has done, and the sin which he has done shall be forgiven. When you come to the land, if you all plant all kinds of trees for food, then you shall count their first fruit as uncircumcised. 3 years it shall remain uncircumcised to you, and it shall not be eaten. The fourth year, fruit shall be holy, a praise to the Lord. In the fifth year, you may eat its fruit, it shall yield as its increase. I am the Lord your God. You shall not eat anything with the blood, nor shall you practice divination or soothsaying. You shall not shave around the sides of your head, nor shall you disfigure the edges of your beard. You shall not make any cuttings in your flesh, the dead or tattoo any marks on you. I am the Lord. Do not prostitute your daughter to cause her to be a harlot, lest the land fall into harlotry, land become full of wickedness. You shall keep my Sabbaths and revere my sanctuary. I am the Lord. Give no regard to mediums and familiar spirits. Do not seek after them, nor be defiled by them. I am the Lord your God. You shall rise for the gray-headed and honor the presence of an old man and fear the Lord your God. I am the Lord. If a stranger sojourns with you in your land, you shall not mistreat him, but the stranger who dwells among you shall be to you as one born among you. You shall love him as yourself, and you were strangers in the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. You shall know injustice and judgment, and measure the length and weight or volume. You shall have just balances and weights, as just an ephah, a just hin. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt. Therefore you shall observe all my statutes, all my judgments, and perform them. I am the Lord your God. I read the whole chapter on purpose. So Leviticus 19 points out the reason for doing all these rules is because it starts out, be holy, because I am holy. And Matthew 5 points out the term holy and perfect are considered synonymous. One and the same. So if Noah was perfect in generations, what's his generation like? Unholy. What's the example of unholy God's pointing out in Leviticus? It's disgusting. It's evil. In the text here in chapter 6 of Genesis, it points out it's corrupt. It has full of robbery. Well, what's the main thing that God points out in Leviticus 19? You're corrupt with sexual immorality as well as robbery, as well as in chapter 11, what you eat is disgusting. So the people that are, if the Bible's taking the term perfect for Noah, and it defines perfect as being holy, then takes the term what isn't holy and just shows you the example, what is holy, what's not holy, what's life like for Noah and his contemporaries. Rather awful. It's debauchery. It's a disgusting world to live in. And God's pointing out, Noah, you aren't like this. You aren't experiencing the evil that is there. It's around you, but you're not part of it. So what's Noah? How perfect is he? He's pretty good. That's very honorable. That's not easy to do when your whole world surrounds you with this evil and you're not partaking in it. That's the type of life, that's the people that we're dealing with at Noah's time. Sexual immorality, robbing, killing, as well as allowing animals to mate with the wrong species. All that's being done. And so when God's going to choose animals to go in the ark, are they going to be descendants of those radiating the wrong species? Are there going to be some animal that is prone to do that or desires to do that? No. Are the people in the ark, are they going to be the type of people who do this type of work? Well, hopefully not. The type of people that God is choosing are trying or attempting to be perfect or holy in the generation. You have a good understanding what it means to be perfect in Noah's time? Good. Because there's more stuff to talk about today. I just want to make sure we understand what it means to be perfect. I bring this up intentionally because in many cultures, I won't say all, but many, they criticize Noah's perfection, pointing out, well, because it says he's perfect in his generations, just means compared to everybody else, he was the best. Maybe he wasn't necessarily that good. Well, that's not fair. That's an unjust definition. And others point out, because he the opposite extreme, well, everybody else was horridly evil, and he was like God. Well, that's also not fair. He can't be that perfect either, as far as flawless in every way. So Noah was perfect, meaning Noah was holy compared to everybody else. Because no one else was holy in Noah's time. Then this is why he was selected. Yes, Jeff.
It was really nice taking that look at the use of the passage there in Matthew, because the illustration that Yeshua is using about that God causes the rain to fall on the just and the unjust.
Yes.
And it's really interesting that you got those two words that are being used there for perfect, for tamim, which is the same as used for sacrifice.
For sacrifices, yep.
Spotless, blameless.
Yep.
And then you had the thing about violence there, it being the word Hamas, and Hamas meaning malice.
Yeah.
So it's very interesting that there was a picture you get of Noah being free of malice. And now you think of what it was that he was assigned to do and build this ark. If you were to be one who's separate from the things going on around you, it would seem to be a tendency to be, wow, they're going to get what they deserve.
Exactly.
But
it's not. It wasn't that way. It's malice toward none.
Right.
He didn't
and
have
so, it. And so you see that, you know, just like, you know, following after the Creator and saying that, look, God is bringing rain on those who are just and unjust, and God has assigned me to do this. And that's what a great picture, I think, that Noah has used as a picture of what God's kingdom message
is
in the earth. It's like, look, get in here. The way that you are considered righteous is to trust me. Don't trust the way the other things are going. And you are on this boat because God has given you favor and chosen you to be on this boat, not because you're so
not because you're perfect, or not because of your own abilities.
Yeah. And, so thus, don't take your malice out on
anybody else.
Consider God's judgment to be, haha, they deserve it.
Right. And that's an important aspect, a very important aspect for Noah, and that he doesn't have an evil bone, so to speak, or an angry bone to people around him. That's not his issue. He doesn't have that. It clearly points out in, I believe it's in Philippians. Let me write that down. Let me double check real quick. Oh no, Peter. That the flood is nothing more than a grand scheme version of baptism. That's what it really is. So when you get baptized, assuming you all have been, or if you haven't been, maybe you will be as you choose to. The whole point is that you're supposed to wash away that which is filthy, not because it's filthy and you're holy, but because part of you, you want to be better. You want to clean. You want to grab a hold of and hold on to God. And God can't take that which is disgusting. You don't have evil hatred toward your neighbors who aren't baptized. I hope you don't. You don't have anger toward somebody who once wronged you umpteen hundred years ago because they did X, Y, Z to your mama and you're mad at them for it. None of that part is there. Your baptism is a personal, individual event. It is just within sight of you. Well, for Noah and his whole family, as it points out, only 8 people made it. That means nobody else was interested. Were interested in changing their ways or going along with what God had instructed. Those 8 people, there's no indication they were angry or upset or felt justified by the God wiping out all those evildoers. Nothing of the sort. They have a job to do, and they're doing the best they can. They're doing not through maliceness. It's important to remember that any gift or holiness doesn't include malice, doesn't include anger, doesn't include righteous indignation. It doesn't work that way. It is a humble experience. Now, I didn't go through every situation or point out to all the points in Leviticus where it discusses the holy for I am holy example. But one that it does talk about, which I believe is in Leviticus 21, I think it's 21, refers to the high priest Aaron. You will be holy for I am holy. Well, think about what the high priest's job is. Is his job to point out and smack him beside the head, look what sin you did this week. Straighten up. Does he do that? No. Each person brings their offering to him. They confess their sins, if there are any, if that's what the offering's for. And he deals it in order to cleanse them and say, now, sin no more. Be stronger. His job is not to assign blame, point fingers, be angry. Well, if he's holy as God is holy, that means God does not point fingers and blame. Therefore, Noah doesn't point fingers and blame. Because Noah was considered perfect generations. He's an honorable man. And clearly, similar to a high priest in this job. Because the high priests are called similarly, as in holy for God is holy. Okay, let's continue on. So now we understand that we're perfect and holy, what that means, and the heart that is within inside him and what that means. Because there's no malice within it. But thank you, Jeff, for pointing out the word that extra term. Let's move forward. Let's see, we'll go to... I'm going to skip certain sections. We'll go to 1 Peter 3. 1 Peter chapter 3, because we're discussing, I already mentioned this once, but we'll go there just to read it, because we, can. 1 Peter chapter 3, I won't read the whole thing, just a few verses here. 1 Peter chapter 3, starting in that's 2 Peter. Verse 18. There it is. 1 Peter chapter 3, starting in verse 18 to the end of the chapter. Messiah also suffered once for sin, the just for the unjust, that he might bring us to God, being put to death in the flesh, made alive the spirit, by whom also he went and preached the spirits in person. Who formerly were disobedient when once the long suffering to God waited in the days of Noah, while the ark was being prepared, in which a few, that is 8 souls, were saved through water. There is also an antitype which now saves us, namely baptism, not the removal of the filth of flesh, but the answer of the good conscience toward God, through the resurrection of the Messiah, who has gone into heaven and is the right hand of God, angels, authorities, and powers having been made subject to him. So in this example, by the way, we're jumping in the middle of a discussion regarding how you're to live and how do you view your life. But he points out in this example in 1 Peter chapter 3, he gives the point out that in Noah's time for the flood, the flood's example is a type of baptism. Oh well. The flood is a type of baptism in their functionality. But he says it's not for the removal of your filth, meaning the flood's goal was not to remove all of man, all the filthiness of mankind. Because did it? No, it didn't. So was it successful? If that was the goal, absolutely not. It was a disaster failure. You know, so that's not the goal. The goal's flood was not for removing filth. Neither is baptism. Filth is not the goal. What's the goal? It's the conscience. Not to kill them all, thanks at all. It's the conscience. To clean your conscience to God. That means it's the inside, your spirit, your soul in you to be clean. The goal of the flood, by the way, who learned from the flood? Did any of the dead people learn anything? No, they didn't. So with the flood, who learned from it? Who benefited? No one, his family. So was the flood for the people who died? No. Was the flood to wipe out the filth? No. What was the flood's job? The same thing that baptism's job is. It's your conscience to clean inside yourselves. So the flood, Noah's family, and note, no one before the flood, unless you led these eight people, made it through. So all the filth that happened supposedly was washed away. That's not true. Because all the filth is still around us. Look around you. The flood's job wasn't to wipe that out. It wasn't at all. Neither is baptism's job. It's not to wash you clean. Go take a bath if you're dirty. Baptism's job is the internal conscience. It's within your soul that we're addressing. So no one is family. The ones who followed and we read the story, what's the goal? What do we learn from it? It's inside of us. Yes, Jeff.
Well, that's fascinating because it really brings into focus something that Peter said later, and I've always kind of wondered what the connection was between these two. He's talking about in the last days the scoffers will come and they purposely forget that the world was judged by water.
Right.
And if the whole point here is to bring the conscience to where your source of cleanliness and where the source of judgment
comes from.
If people purposely forget where that big judgment came from to begin with, or that there even was a big judgment, then they're not going to think anything about any sort of judgment to come.
Exactly. And which we'll get to that later on, too, for the exact reason. That's perfectly put. This is an important event. There's a flood. It's not about the filth of dirtiness and the robbery of people. It's about Noah and his family remembering how important it is not to be filthy. How important it is not to be robbery. How important it is not to be unholy. It's their learning experience. Baptism is the same for each one of us individually. It's not to make us, oh, well, all my past now washed away, I'm clean. No, it's not. It's to remember you don't want to be like your past. So you don't want to live like you once were. It's your conscience gets seared in that moment of baptism. It's the same point that this flood was supposed to sear the conscience of Noah and his family. And we already discussed earlier about the consciousness of the entire culture, all the different family groups and nations that came from it. They had this never-ending memory of its record of some massive flood wiping things out. It was supposed to permanently sear that into us that, hey, there is something greater than us. We don't want to live like that. So the lesson for the flood was for Noah and his family. So is baptism for each one of us. So Peter points that out very clearly in this instance. So that's what we should be learning from with the flood. It's not about wiping out the bad guys or killing a bunch of people. Kill them all. It's about remembering our actions and our conduct and what our goal is, which Philippians talks about that. We might get to that later today too. Any questions so far? Good. Let's see here. Let's jump to... Let's move past this whole idea of of the perfectness and cleaning up and holiness. We have other things to talk about. Let's jump to, go back to Genesis chapter 6. Now, in the example here, Genesis chapter 6, going in the people that enter the ark. Okay, so all the ones that enter the ark. I'm going to erase this because I don't need this part anymore. Who all gets to go in the ark? How many of each kind? We talked about that briefly already. We'll talk about just a little bit more, one more detail to rattle off to you about it. So in the ark, we have two pairs of unclean. And it has a breath of life in it. That means you'll breathe. We're not including fish. They have the water. They breathe too, but that's not included in the ark. So unclean, that includes animals that walk, that creep. And also includes insects. Insects and birds. My marker's going in. So all these unclean, two of each kind. So yeah, we got ants. We have cockroaches. We have other beetles. A few other things that we don't care for anymore, but guess what? They're there too. Helps we're going to clean ourselves up, right? So there's insects. There's also birds. But the birds are both clean and unclean. But there's something else in the birds too. So two pair are supposed to be. But the birds, he says, wait a minute. I want seven of the birds. So we have seven. I'm going to choose a marker. This black marker is shot for me. Seven birds. Or seven pairs, sorry. The seven was the clean, which are obviously the animals. There are only a few clean insects. There's, you know, the locusts and I'm not sure what else is. There's probably a few. There's a few creeping ones. The locusts are there. So there's some insects that are clean. I'm not saying you should go eat them because the idea is really gross. But there's also the birds, and it doesn't specify clean or unclean. Why is that? So you've got seven sets of vultures, as well as seven sets of, you know, chickens and quail. See, the difference is God pointed out there's the clean animals. There's also the birds in its own separate category. But it also gets seven sets. That's how it's written. Now, we could argue that he's referring to clean birds versus unclean birds, but it doesn't specify that in the language written out. Birds get seven sets. Why would God do that? Why do you want lots of birds? He likes birds. There are a couple reasons for he likes birds. The answer to that, they can spread seed, they can spread the earth and spray the earth very, very quickly, but what good is a vulture, right? Why would you want, vultures don't spread seeds, they do other things too. A lot of cleanup afterward. There's going to be a lot of dead things hanging out, and you're going to want birds that consume that stuff up quickly because they're very good at it. There's a symbolic reason, too. Revelation discusses it. Birds have a meaning for God that's a little bit different than the clean animals. Book of Revelation, jump to 19. We read this briefly back at Sukkot. Revelation 19, we go to the tail end of that chapter. It's going to go to we'll jump in verse 17 of Revelation 19. I saw an angel standing in the sun. He cried with a loud voice, saying to all the birds that fly in the midst of heaven, come, gather together for the supper of the great God, that you may eat the flesh of kings, the flesh of captains, the flesh of mighty men, the flesh of horses and those who sit upon them, the flesh of all people, free and slave, both small and great. I saw the beast, the kings of the earth, and their armies gathered together to make war against him who sat on the horse and against his army. Then the beast was captured, and with him the false prophet who worked signs in his presence, which he deceived those who received the mark of the beast and those who worshipped the image. These two were cast alive into the lake of fire, burning with brimstone. The rest were killed with the sword, which proceeded from the mouth of him who sat on the horse. And all the birds were filled with their flesh. birds have a special place in God's heart. Their job, they're being invited to the supper of the Lamb. Now, mind you, we talked about this briefly at Sukkot. There's a couple of characters being played out in this marriage supper. There's obviously the Lamb himself, you know, the Messiah. God clearly is there as well. So is his bride. And then also, now we have all the birds. So we have these various characters played out in this, in that story in Revelation. So you have the Messiah. There's a bride. There's I-E-D. And then there's God, which he's, there's obviously angels as well. There's God's hanging out. There's also the birds. And of course, then you have all their various dead people. The who die, all the people who die. Who gets invited to the marriage supper? Well, clearly, Messiah is there. His bride is there. God's always there. And birds are there. The people who die, are they invited? Sort of, they're the meal. Symbolically speaking, who are the birds? This is the complex issue. When you're dealing with a bride and you're dealing with birds, neither one of them are quite so obvious as their identity. God pointed out to Israel, be holy for I am holy. And he says what you should eat, what you shouldn't eat, how you contaminate yourselves, don't contaminate yourselves. God pointed out because he lifted up the animals that were clean. So clean animals are lifted up. Well, of all the people groups on earth, which group was lifted up? Israel. So clean animals are lifted up, and Israel lifted up. The clean animals are lifted up to be food. You eat them, you stay holy. You don't eat them, you eat unclean, you're not holy. Israel is supposed to be lifted up as well, and their conduct defines holy versus unholy. So the clean animals, whether you eat them or don't eat them, that's the definition of holy, and Israel lifted up their conduct, definition of holy. Therefore, the clean animals and Israel are one and the same, symbolically speaking. They're both lifted up to be holy. So if I was going to look at this example, Messiah, the bride, the God, the birds, the people who are unholy down here, the dead people, who would the bride then be? The bride would be Israel, because they're the ones lifted up to be holy. He's going to marry a holy bride. The birds aren't part of that. Who are they? The guests. Those who get from the wayside who are gathered. Those who aren't holy by their definition of Israel, but they're gathered as they're the parable about the king giving inviting to a wedding supper. And he invites all the guests that were supposed to attend, and none of them wanted to come. I'm busy doing this. I'm busy doing that. I'm busy doing whatever. And he said that more to the gathers, those for the wayside, the ones who read the rejects, the poor, the ones who are unacceptable in society, and they're the ones that come to his guests. Those are your birds. It's the guests, the poor, the rejects, the ones that nobody wants. That's where your birds come from. That's where the symbolism comes from. So how many does God want in birds? A whole bunch. That's why there's seven sets of pairs in each one of them. Of all the birds, clean and unclean. He wants the guests. He wants those to attend. The ones that are the rejects. The ones nobody else wants. That's his goal. Get them. He also wants the clean animals, meaning Israel. Those who are supposed to be holy because he is holy. Live your life holy. So God has guests for him. He also has a bride for him, for his son. Those are the examples were given in the definition of birds. So why would God want lots of birds? He's going to throw a big party, and they're the ones invited. Yes.
I was just going to say it's interesting, and you were in 19, and you go back to 18.
Sexual immorality, yeah.
No, and I was going to say, and he cried out with a mighty voice. This is the angel that came down with the illumination.
Right.
And he cried out with a mighty voice, saying, "Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. She has become a dwelling place of demons and a prison of every unclean spirit and a prison of every unclean and hateful bird."
Yeah. Unclean and hateful. Are those the kind that God wants in his wedding supper? No. The poor and the rejects is what he's after. To make sense? So that's what he's after. That's what his goal is, to gather them together into it. They are the guests. They are the ones who come to the wedding supper, who is, of course, his son is marrying his bride. Hopefully that makes sense in the symbolism was what the clean animals and how God was using the birds and the unclean animals and their insects too, and how it was all working together in this symbol. We have more to cover. Any questions so far? I'm doing pretty well on time. No, I'm not going to repeat it again, sorry. All right, let's move forward, because there's stuff to talk about here. Let's see here. I'm not going to discuss all the details of timing. There's a few, you know, minor points, chapter 7. It points out the force of they enter the ark on the 17th day of the second month. 150 days later, the 17th day of the seventh month, is when the waters recede enough to where the ark touches something or settles on top of Mount Ararat. I don't know how tall Mount Ararat is, because no one really knows which mountain it is. Wherever it settled, it stopped there. And of course, they had to wait and wait and wait before they could see any other mountaintops. I'm assuming they could see their own, but maybe they couldn't, because the window at the very top, you can't really look down so easily. So either way, they couldn't see their own mountain. But they could see other mountains, obviously, a few months later. Doing the basic math, which I mentioned once before, a couple months ago, that means the original dates, which God pointed out, he has about 30 days in a given month. Which is how his original creation was. I point that out each time because it's my own way of refuting the lunar Sabbath people because they drive me at the wall. Lunar Sabbath people drive me at the wall. The fact that the first day of a month is your first day of the week, regardless of how many days there are in. It's my own thing. It's a pet peeve because their argument was that when God first created things and created the whole world, a month was 28 days long. That's not true. It's a philosophy thing, but I point it out every time I get a chance because it drives me at the wall. The Lunar Sabbath people really drive me at the wall. Anyhow, so I point that out. So God first created the mankind, first created the world. A month was about 30 days long. Today it's like pretty close to that. 29 point something. I forgot what it is. It's close to 30. It hasn't changed a whole lot. Although he was more accurate then than it is now. Time has happened. Let's see here. Another point out to those who have been taught this. The first month of the year is in Aviv. It's in the springtime. I know Judaism teaches that at time of creation, up until they came out of Egypt, the first month was what we call the seventh month. There is no indication that's the case because God never changes. If God doesn't change, then the first month was always the first month, whether man knew it or not. Therefore, when God created Adam and Eve, most likely it was not in the seventh month. It would have been back in spring, the first month. So, no, all the cycle, as we understand first, seventh, and tenth month, is similar to what we currently understand first, seventh, and tenth month. Not a lot has changed because God doesn't change. Yes.
Yeah, otherwise, the references to them would make no sense.
Exactly, it'd be completely arbitrary.
Yeah, if the first month changed in Exodus, then, you know, what does all the stuff in Genesis mean?
Nothing. Exactly. It would all be junk. So, it's my own pet peeve. I've run across enough times. What was that? Oh, that's a lunar Sabbath. But that's a separate issue. There's lunar Sabbath people who believe. Well, the other Judaism teaches that the first month in creation was Tishri, the seventh month today, which be in September, October. That's what Judaism teaches. It's a philosophy. They believe the Rosh Hashanah, the head of the year, that was God's first creation day. That is backwards. That makes... No, they both believe. They both believe. Every school of Judaism teaches the first of the creation was in the seventh month of our current year annual cycle, which would be Yom Teruah or Rosh Hashanah today, as far as the first day of creation. That wouldn't make any logical sense in God's way of doing things. Yes? Elul would be the last day, the 29th day of Elul, the last day. The seventh month is Tishri. Elul is the sixth month. So that's their belief, that that's when God was creating, and that that's how his cycle worked. It's not, it makes no sense. It's bogus, because that implies that God changes himself and his own creation out of arbitrary choice, unnecessarily. So it's junk. It would have been month of spring. We call it Aviv, which would be sometime around March or April, when the first year, or first month of the year. And then, so all the second month refer to, obviously, when it starts into the ark. That event occurs in the middle of what we call second Passover, because Passover is allowed twice. In case the first Passover you're sick or you're contaminated by something else, whatever the case may be, you can't attend the first Passover. You're allowed to the second one. It's a month later. So Noah enters the ark in the middle of the second Passover, the 17th day of the second month. It's the middle of the Passover week of number two, or the unleavened bread number two. So that's when he enters the ark. That has its own symbolism as to why that was done. Yes, Carrie.
I was just, because I wrote down the dates that are marked in chapter 6. And I just noticed, because the 17th day of the month is Resurrection Day. Like, if you, you know.
Right.
So the 17th day of the second month is basically also,
it's Resurrection Day number two.
For the alternate Passover. And in the New Testament, I can't remember where, but baptism is also linked with resurrection with Messiah.
Yep.
And so just, it just,
they're all
I found it interesting that baptism is linked with resurrection and the rain started on Resurrection Day.
On that Resurrection Day, which is the time which baptism was occurring for all the people. It is a beautiful picture when you write this all out. She's absolutely right. The second month, you know, if Messiah dies the evening of the, you know, the 14th before sunset, blah, blah, he comes up, he resurrects roughly on the 17th, that particular day, 3 days later. So the first, I wrote this backwards, first being top, second bottom, first. The first 17th day, that would be Messiah's resurrection, which we get the whole idea of, okay, now your sins are set aside. They're put away. I'm passing over them. I'm pretending they're not there anymore. That's Messiah's resurrection event. So your sins are passed away. Or passed over, sorry. Not passed away. Passed. P-A-S-S-E-D. Over. In the 17th month for Noah, the sins start getting washed away. You get baptized. Same type of event. The same philosophical belief. If you believe in Messiah, guess what happens to your sins? They're washed away. You don't have to pay for them. Baptism, what's the symbolism? Your sins, they get washed away. You don't pay for them anymore. That's the whole idea behind the symbolism there. So in the first month, the 17th month, it would be the normal Passover resurrection moment in time. Because mind you, if Messiah died and was not resurrected, would any of this all work? No. You throw the whole book away. It's a joke. So clearly it's the resurrection part that actually made it work. So this sin passed over, sins get washed away. Noah, it's the second month. Now, as I pointed out earlier, when you're attending Passover, you get to attend the first month unless you're unclean, you're unfit, you're not ready, you can't attend. Well, what is earth in the time of Noah? Is it ready? No, it's not. Is it fit? No, it's not. What's God going to say? Okay, you're not ready. We'll do the next one. You get a month to figure it out. And does God, theoretically, a month later, clean yourself up? You better be ready by then, because your time's up. So the first month for Noah, God didn't choose. Because the earth wasn't ready. Instead, God gave the second month. Oh, this is all Aviv. also known as Passover, or time of Passover, which would be in March or April. At that time of that time, it's the first holy day cycle, which we're discussing here. It's the first and second month. In the time when you have a second month, it's basically a month after the first one, because you were unclean to partake in the first Passover. So you're looking at, you know, either late April or May. That time period, April, May, is roughly when Noah's flood began, as far as how it went for 40 days and fountain's teeth were burst open. So the whole symbolism we're seeing here is that God's allowing the people all the time imaginable. And he didn't even do it on the 15th day. He waited till the 17th day of the second month, which is the time of resurrection. The last possible second to believe in him is given to everyone. And does anybody follow? Only Noah and his family. So he's given every time, all the time, symbolically allowed. And it still didn't quite work. People still didn't follow. So the symbolism behind this is all based on the holiday cycle and how God was using Noah and his story in the events of Passover and events of the baptism, events of the flood, as overlay over each other. They're symbolically similar events. These stories are all connected together. That's the whole point behind them. That's why God wrote it that way. He wasn't, it wasn't by accident. God has chosen to make these things overlinked each other so we could see and recognize there's symbols and therefore there's purpose. If there's purpose, then there's a direction you're supposed to follow. See, there's no purpose, you have no goal, you have no reason to get there. But if you have a purpose and a symbol behind the purpose explaining it, now you have a goal and you know how to get there. That's why we learn these things. Let's continue on. Noah sends out the birds. I'm going to erase this stuff because I don't need to eat more. Say it again. It is. It's a wonderful story. And God did a great job setting it just right so we can see what we're supposed to learn from it. So when it's all said and done, okay, Noah opens the ark up. Let's send out some birds. His first choice is a raven. Also known as the carrion crow. It's another title for it. That's a carry. That's an R, not a P. Yeah, it's a dirty bird. What's its job? Eat anything. Dead things that are putrid and disgusting. Raven's job is to eat. It's called a carrion crow because its job is to eat things that are dead, decaying, and putrid. Why? Why would Moses send that out? Take a wild guess. What's outside the ark? A lot of dead things. So what's he finding out with the raven? What's dead out there? Well, what's dead out there? Is there a bunch of dead bodies floating around? Because mind you, Noah can't see them. He's not out there fishing for dead bodies with his, you know, fishing stick, fishing pole. He doesn't look for those things. He doesn't know what's out there. A bird can spot things far easier than anybody else can. A bird can spot floating, disgusting, gross things all over the place. And what's the raven doing? Flying back and forth. He sees or finds nothing. Noah is, but the raven is looking for something else. What's raven been cooped up inside of the ark for a year? Eating seed. And what did God give to the ravens and eat? Not seed. What isn't seed? After the flood, what isn't seed? Well, that's a living thing, a living, dead, whatever it is. So the raven is supposed to find something. Obviously, Noah's wanting him to see if there's water free or not, if there's still water. But he chose the raven on purpose. The raven's looking for dead things. Are there dead things? Nope. He can't find them. Nothing there. It just flies back and forth. There's no indication. That tells Noah God didn't just whack us all and plop us down the top of the dirt. There aren't dead things hanging out on top of the stuff. It means to Noah, God buried them. That's important. Because if God left everything hanging out on the top, what happens to the land? It's contaminated and disgusting. You wouldn't want to farm. You don't want to walk. You don't want to do anything. So God, in his infinite wisdom, brought the flood and then also buried them at the same time. Brilliant. kill him, bury him, case done. So the raven finds nothing dead to eat, to hang out with or consume. It's going back and forth doing its business, still searching. Meanwhile, it doesn't say the raven came back. It means it didn't come back into the ark. The raven's going back and forth, flying around above the ark. Probably hangs out on top. You've seen ravens. What do? They like to hang out high where they can see. So they're probably on top of the ark looking around. The raven doesn't find dead things at all to eat. So Noah sends out the dove. Now, what a dove. Do they eat dead things? No. What do they eat? Seeds. And what is a dove going to go look for after a whole year of eating seeds, cooped up in a ark? It's going to find a home. A place. You've seen doves. What do? They hang out in bushes and trees. They fly in a safe area, and they make their noises. What are the noises they make? So what's a dove going to look for? It's not looking for the dead things. That's the raven's job. What's a dove looking for? Live things. That's the dove's job. And what's going to be alive after a flood? Is it going to be animals? No. What's going to be alive after a flood? Plants. So that's what the dove's job is. So Noah sent out the raven and the dove. Look for dead things. Look for live things. What do you find? The raven finds nothing. The dove finds life. So what tells Noah? There's life back. The dead has now been washed away and buried. That's great.
Is this possible where all the vegetation, animals, and humans?
Yeah. The vegetation should have been buried too, which is interesting, which it was, but yet the vegetation, at least enough of it, wasn't. Enough of it was still up and around and functional. I don't know how God did it all. I'm not brilliant. He is. So however he did and did the vegetation, made it all work out, I realized seeds can float for a long time. Maybe that's what he did. I don't know. And somehow those seeds got in the middle of the islands, middle of nowhere in the Pacific Ocean some way. So they can float pretty well. However God did it, he made the vegetation come back or survive. And obviously the dead things and dead animals and such to go away. Now let's go to chapter 9. It discusses, before we leave there. Noah comes out of the ark. He gives a sacrifice offering of every clean animal. One sample of it. I do not know how many clean animals there are. I'm not sure. Maybe they had birth while they were on the ark. I have no knowledge at all. But either way, he offered one of each. Now, God didn't smack him to the head and say, what are you doing? I just saved 7 pairs, and now you just wiped out one of the pairs. He didn't say that. What was his response? He was thankful. He was grateful. He points out in chapter 8, verse 11. Sorry, not verse 7, verse 21. It says, Noah built the ark to the Lord and took of every clean animal, of every clean bird, and offered a burnt offering on the altar. The Lord smelled the pleasing aroma. The Lord said in his heart, I will not continue to curse again the ground because of man, since the imagery of man's heart is evil from his youth. Nor will I again continue to smite every living being as I have done. Continuously all the days of the earth, seed time, harvest, cold, heat, summer, winter, day and night, shall not cease. So this offering that Noah gives accomplishes a few things. It's not about whacking off one of the pears. So he gives an offering. He obviously said the clean animals. So he has 7 pairs of clean animals. Well, now he's got 6.5 pairs of clean animals left. So 6.5 pairs. I'm assuming he sacrificed the males, not the women, I would hope. The 6.5 pairs left, is God mad at him? No. What does God say in his heart? Now I say this, I'm questioning this question to this point. Do any of us get to hear God's heart? No, we don't. I can't hear his heart. I can hear words he chooses to tell me, but I can't hear his heart. That's inside of him. It's inside of you and me. I can't hear your heart. I can see your actions. And I can hear the words you say. But I can't see the heart. But in God's heart, he smells the offering and he's pleasing. And he does 2 agreements. There are 2. What were the 2 agreements? Cursing the ground. Yeah. And was it the curse? Or the other agreement he made? The flood and the seasons. The flood will never happen again in the seasons. So, they didn't offer any fruit. What's up with Cain and Abel, man? There was no fruit being offered. It's all the animals. So, in God's agreement, in this event, in this final accomplishment, he points out that the curse of the ground, we point out that happened back with Adam and Eve. And why was that? What did they do to earn that, the cursed ground? They ate of the fruit they weren't supposed to eat of. So after this event, the cursed ground goes away, which came from Adam and Eve. So after the offering and the flood, everything else occurred, in God's heart, he said, all right, I'm going to uncurse the ground and I'll bless it again. Does that mean he got rid of all the thorns and thistles? No, it's still there. You can go out there and look around the place. Go the goat's heads we step on every summer, they're still out there and they still hurt. So yeah, they're still around. The goat's heads, the little seeds, they're spiky little seeds. They're really pointy. They hurt like crazy. They're still around, but the ground will grow. He also agreed he would not do the flood again, to kill mankind, the flood. What's the next form of baptism that comes after the flood? Fire. I didn't have to use flood, right? Because what's the God? He said he would never destroy mankind in the form of flood again, because the next time he's going to do it is called fire. Which is a little different. The opposite extreme, right? So he'll go to fire next time. The flood's done. The seasons will not end. He agrees, of course, that's part of the cycle of events. This is all in God's heart, which God agrees to do it. He also points out there is a sign in chapter 9, discusses what the sign is going to be, which is the rainbow. We'll discuss what that means momentarily. I'm out of time, technically, so I'm going to make this really quick, the last few minutes here. In chapter 9, so we already said about the unclean animals, because Noah already knows what is and isn't clean. That's obviously pointed out in the story of it in and of itself. So I point this out, that God doesn't usually tell us what's in his heart, but this example, these details, are spelled out more or less to Noah later in chapter 9, as he points out when God's discussing the flesh and the cleaning of the waters. So in chapter 9, he reiterates outwardly his thoughts he had inwardly in chapter 8. I will confirm, this is verse 11 of chapter 9, I will confirm my covenant with you. Never again shall all flesh be cut off by the waters of flood. Never again shall there be a flood to destroy the earth. So that part he confirms outwardly. And the curse of the ground is obvious to Noah because he gets to plant vineyards. And guess what? They grow. Clearly God didn't curse the ground. He uncursed it. Yeah. It does. It takes a number of years. So let's continue on. Let's move a little bit forward because I'm going to end this real fast with the family. We get to go to the family real quick. Now, obviously, there are lots and lots of sons. I'm going to erase this because I don't need it anymore. Noah's three sons. They have their own children and such. One of the issues obviously happens after the flood, shortly thereafter. Ham does something to Noah. It's unknown what it is. The nakedness. Oops. Naked. Now, we look at nakedness pretty loosely today. That's pretty obvious. Just go online. You'll find, every naked thing you can imagine is there. Nakedness is very common today. So it's not a big deal. Well, we don't know what nakedness Ham, or maybe it was Canaan, we're not quite sure which one, because Canaan's the one who received the curse, happened to Noah. But whatever it was, when Noah woke up after his stupor, the evidence apparently was still there, whatever occurred. There's lots of opinions. One argument, he castrated him. That's one argument. Are you not going to castrate someone who's passed out from alcohol? Sorry. They'll wake up. They'll notice that. There are a lot of different beliefs and ideas as far as what he did and didn't do. I don't care. I have no clue. I have no clue if it's circumcision or not. I couldn't tell you. I would incline to believe, I would argue probably not. Just say probably. Because in Philippians, he points out that the process of the flood and the baptism, the whole idea there, is that when you're done and you've gone through this washing away, you are now the circumcision. You are what was cut. See, that's what you become. It's possible you could argue it's a circumcision issue. I couldn't tell you. I have no knowledge of it. There's lots of speculation. I really don't care. It's just speculation. So whatever he did, it was obviously an issue that Noah was upset with. Now it points out that the boys did not, or sons, did, they're not boys anymore, did not look upon their father's nakedness, so they put the clothing on the backwards and they walked him backwards and draped him or covered him up. Nakedness in your own tent, is that a problem? No, it's not. Guess what? You have to get dressed. How many have been naked in your own houses? Well, yeah, I take a shower, change your clothes. We're naked all the time. What do? You close the door. We don't like people watching our nakedness, do we? Well, most of us don't like watching our nakedness. We usually close the door. If there's other people in the house, hey, I don't want my kid walking on me. I'm changing my clothes. I'm taking a shower. I close the door. We choose our privacy. We still have it. That's still in us. We still want our privacy. So it's still important to us. And it bothers us when somebody walks in on us and we're not obviously anticipating or expecting such a thing. So nakedness is still an issue to us. It's just different. Yes, Jeff.
One of the things points to this a little bit is the little bit of the contrast with the nakedness and shame that you see in Genesis chapter 3.
They are tied together.
And one of the things that's interesting here is the approach that was taken, because you see that you have the other sons act with great deference and respect, but one son did not act with deference or respect and actually dishonored
by
his
spreading
father.
It.
And I'm wondering if the great sin is not honoring his father, because that is one of the big ten.
I'm heading to that one next. Yeah. Now, as in my example I was given a minute ago. Oh, go ahead.
I'm sorry, but Noah didn't have any more kids.
No.
After he came out of the ark.
Correct. Just the three boys. Right. There are no more children. Still many years. I forgot how many more years. If it's like 400 years, something like that. Afterward. So here's the detail. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
The reason I'm always curious exactly what happened, but the one son saw it, and then it was his son who was cursed. It wasn't the son that was cursed. It was his son that was cursed. So did the grandson do something that the father saw, and Noah figured that out?
It's possible. That's why the belief that maybe the grandson was involved somehow, or maybe it was with his son, or something had occurred. We don't know who did what and how it was done, but obviously Noah addressed the child over the dad. But let's discuss this a little briefly. So let's imagine for a moment you're getting dressed in your own chambers, your own bedroom, changing clothes. One of your kids walks in on you. They run out. Oh, guess what I saw? Are you pleased with that child? No. They were standing against the wall. Swat your behind for doing that. That's what you do. Yeah, nose the wall. The child gets in trouble, right? That's what the belief is that Ham may have done, and that it's a dishonor. He pointed out to his siblings, guess what I saw? Or guess what dad did? It shows a dishonor to the parent, which then openly shames the parent in the eyes of the other siblings. That's what it does. It's a shame of people. So it's not necessarily that Ham saw him without clothing on, or his grandson saw him without clothing, or Canaan did. The point is, what did he do about it? That may be the issue. Yes, Jeff.
Well, yeah, Pat brings up an interesting point of why the son was condemned. And I wonder again, you know, just looking at the fifth commandment here in Exodus 20, verse 12, honor your father and your mother that your days may be long in the land that the Lord your God has given you. The land that Canaan got was land called Canaan. What happened to Canaan in
got
the land
taken
that
away.
Was given? It got taken away from him.
It got taken away. So, as we point out, the curse that Canaan received from Noah, as Somebody pointed out that he had lots and lots of kids anyway, and had lots and lots of territory. Was he able to keep any of it? No. Almost all of it got taken away. He kept getting pushed out and pushed out and pushed out and pushed out. Someone else came along and took it. Someone else comes along and takes it. Again and again and again. You think, well, but his descendants also took Egypt. Yeah, but only for a while. Eventually, the Egyptians got pushed out too. It got replaced with new people who came in. Every land that Canaan, the descendants took, and they had, they didn't get to stay there for that for forever. It was a period of time and they got pushed away. They got taken away and they got pushed out. So Noah's curse doesn't necessarily have to mean that he is a slave all the time, but that rather he is subject to all the time. You can be a subject to as well as a slave. Yes, Pat.
Well, I keep wondering, and reason I wonder that the grandson must have been involved, because Ham had other children too, and it was only the one child that was cursed.
Right.
So why is that?
It's possible the only child that existed at the time. I don't know. Yeah. But my inclination is somehow there was an event that involved Canaan as well. I don't know what it is. I can't say precisely what it was. Yes. Yeah,
but there's a possible scenario that Ham really did
do something.
See his nakedness. And if you were going to hurt a parent, what would be the worst way you could hurt that parent? That's through your child.
That's true. It's possible to do. It's definitely possible to do. So the last thing I want to talk about, I can't tell you more information about the event that occurred there because there isn't any more given. It's all speculation. Sorry about that. Yeah, just know as much as I can. Lots of descendants. So-and-so begat so-and-so begat so-and-so. I'm not going to go through all the lists. It takes forever. Quick family line tree. I get to write up here because I like family trees. They're fun. So Terah. We finally find Terah in this whole line of list. He gets, actually there's four. He has Abram, and then Nahor, and Haran. Haran. And his three sons. That's an N. Now, later on we hear, or Abram with Sarah points out to, I think it's the Egyptian pharaoh, that she is his sister of his father, not his mother. So it appears that Terah also had a daughter named Sarah. Sarai, actually. Sarah. Is it A-I? Oh, well. Sarai? Hey, I forgot to spell the name right. Haran has at least one son named Lot. He also has a daughter. Two daughters. Come on, spell her name right. Milhaka and Iskar. Iriska. It's Iskar. He has a son and, of course, two daughters. Nahor has a few children, but Bethuel, who then later on has two children, Laban and Rebecca. Abram, of course, with Sarai. They have Isaac, and of course he has two sons, Esau and Jacob. Now, the family line is very important to them. Note that Rebecca, of course, you know, marries Isaac. Laban's two daughters, Rachel and Leah, marry Jacob. You have, obviously, Abram marries Sarai. Nahor marries Milcah. I'm not sure who Bethuel married. The family line goes really straight up and down. Okay, just saying. There's a lot of intermarriage going on then. Of course, Lot has two sons. There's Moab and Ammon. Both went from his daughter. I forgot his daughter. Two daughters' names. Whatever. I don't think it lists their names. I don't think it's the same. Anyway. He married, or not marries, but he yes. has relations with his two daughters. Yeah, a bad country song. Yeah, so his daughters that have all this. So there's a lot of intermarriage and inner this and inner that going on in all this details. Of course, Esau marries Canaanite women as well as some descendants of Abram's other son, Ishmael. he marries one of his daughters. I forgot her name. And one of her daughters over here also comes down and marries Esau. I'm not sure how many kids they have. The family line goes very vertical, as far as they're very intertwined together. It's not by accident. Note, today we have obviously serious issues with that, with genetic problems and duplications and all this other stuff happens, and genetic code errors. And so in the Torah, it actually explains later on when what relationships are permitted, what are not. But the Torah shows up and Moses goes through, hey, what you can and who you can and cannot marry. Most of all this is illegal. I say most because I don't think the daughter of Ishmael and Esau is a problem, but I could be wrong on that. I have to double check. Most of it's illegal, but at this time it isn't a problem. There aren't genetic issues. You could call it West Virginia. I don't know. There's probably a few Dakotas might fit in there too somewhere. The point of all this in all this storyline is that what family was God working with? Terah's family. God's working with Terah's family. When you're going to marry someone, is it wise to marry somebody who believes as you do or does not believe as you do? Believe as you do. What happens if you don't? You're in trouble. Things fall apart. It doesn't stick together. It doesn't work. So in this case, what they're doing is they're saying, I'm going to choose people who are following or attempting to follow some variation or some belief of a God. And the God that actually worked with or dealt with Noah and his sons. That particular one. The other families can choose who they wish. Now, mind you, in this all this intermarriage, are there lots and lots and lots of people on the earth? Not really. There really aren't that many. They're still populating from Noah's line. They're still growing up. Don't be wrong. There are thousands to choose from, but there aren't millions. So they're still intertwined. Now, all these to choose from, there's still lots of different beliefs and ideas. You know, Nimrod happened. It occurred. Babel happened. It occurred. And Babel happened, by the way, while Abram was still alive. So the Tower of Babel and the splitting of the languages, he was probably in his 30s when that event occurred. So they're all there. They're all hanging out in the same territory, same area. They know each other. They know Nimrod. They know the family line. They know each other. They're hanging out. They have this family line. So Abram doesn't have a child since he's like 100 years old. But in his 30s, when they're coming out of Ur of Chaldea, when Terah's leaving, that's all happening. All these guys are alive. That's the speculation. Some believe that Haran may have died at that event of the Tower of Babel. Yes?
Well, if you think about it, that certainly would have narrowed their marital options if you have all these languages getting mixed up
exactly.
And being sent away.
Yep. So I don't know how many languages God made originally. I'm assuming 70. So all the people came out of Noah's line. 70 groups God divided up. He may or may not have made them even. I don't know. But he made at least a bunch of languages. They all split. And how many of them are left? Well, it's 1/70th of the options are now left. So intermarriage is still not only permissible, it's probably one of your few options you actually have. And it doesn't become an issue until obviously later years down. So this is our family line, which we're going to deal with, and Jeff gets to run with next week, and gets to talk about how they interact and what they do. So any questions or comments regarding this Torah section? Hope I covered it decently enough. Let's end with a prayer, if you don't mind. Almighty God, our great Heavenly Father, thank you for teaching us and showing us what is good and right in your eyes. Father, please help us to understand and learn and follow where you lead. May we hear your voice, Father, always. And grant us peace and strength, and grant those whom we love strength. Teach us well, Father. When we see when we were baptized and the sins are washed away and the life that we are choosing to lead and to not return. We ask your blessing, Father, and the rest of this Shabbat and our time together and our families. In Yeshua's name we pray. Amen.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's hallel.info, hallel.info.